know what really makes us mad? Is wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Tell them about punk!
What's up, Hosers? Welcome to Punk's Lotto Pod. I'm your co-host, Justin Hensley.
I am your other co-host, Dylan Hensley.
And today we are joined by the host of the excellent podcast, Fly on the Call. We're joined by Scott Fuger. Scott, how are you?
I'm doing well.
I feel like we owe you an apology. We had originally scheduled you to be on the show back in, what, March? And then the world kind of, you know, exploded with COVID. And so we canceled on you the day of the recording after you emailed me asking if we were going to have it. So apologies for that.
No worries. No worries. Totally understandable.
Yeah, it's been an insane 3 months.
It's not even April yet, right? It's still March, I think.
Yeah. It feels like it.
For those unfamiliar with your show, I guess you would describe it, it's an interview show, but it's more like, it's real loose, I would say, right? Like, it's more conversational type, you know, like how the type of podcast that Joe Rogan does, where it's just, like, really long conversations.
I don't know if that's a compliment or not, but it's true, yeah. I mean, the tagline is kind of like candid conversations on music, so, you know, I kind of... You know, I do try to let it flow kind of however is natural. And, you know, I do deep dives as much as I can and really try to get to the stuff that, you know, I'm really interested in and think that will be valuable to other people. And hopefully people years from now will see it and, you know, find out about an obscure band like the one we're talking about today.
Yeah, yeah, really obscure. I guess people who've listened to this show regularly who maybe haven't heard your show, I'd compare it to something like Angry Girl Music or Pass the Mic, you know, like these sort of longer form like interviews with musicians. So it's a great show. I feel those three shows together are like probably the best source of like new music and newer bands on like the podcast scene, I guess, that you can find. It's a great show and I highly recommend everyone check it out.
Thank you very much. I was definitely honored when you reached out.
So this is the show where we assign our guest a year, and they choose one punk, hardcore, emo, punk-adjacent record to make us listen to and talk about. So this week, we assigned you the year 1977. Before we get to the album we're talking about today, we decided to take a look at a couple other records that came out in 1977. So, Dylan, why don't you take us away on that?
I mean, it's 1977. It's the birth of punk. I mean, it's all the big ones. Other than, like, it's not the first Ramones record, you know? Like, it's two Ramones records.
Yeah.
Rocket to Russia and Leave Home. But it's also, I mean, it's the year of Nevermind the Bollocks, here's the Sex Pistols, you know, Talking Heads, the first Clash record, big, big stuff.
Yeah, it's we've talked about 1977 a couple times before when we did remember which one. Oh, we did The Boys' self-titled album, and we did The Jam's This Is the Modern World. Have we done any other albums from 77?
No. We have talked about The Saints, Radio Birdman, other bands that were active at this time, but not those specific.
Scott, do you have a favorite record from 77?
I'd say the one that I'm probably most familiar with would be Rocket to Russia. I mean, the Ramones are obviously... I think I came into them through Guitar Hero, probably, as I did much of my musical taste. But, I mean, Sheena's a Punk Rocker, Rockaway Beach, the Teenage Lobotomy, those are all definitely, like, you know, some of the classic, like, punk songs that, you know, come to mind for me when I think of punk.
It's funny, you came to Ramones through Guitar Hero. We probably came to them through Tony Hawk.
Yeah, because... Yeah, because Blitzkrieg Bop was in, what, Tony Hawk 3?
I think so.
I was so late to Tony Hawk. The only one I've played is American Wasteland, which it has a really great soundtrack still, but not one of the more classic ones.
Yeah, I think that's where we had actually cut off, because, like...
Yeah, because whenever they stopped making PlayStation 1 versions... I think that's when we stopped playing Tony Hawk games, because we were very late. I was very late to getting a PlayStation 2. We didn't get the PlayStation 2 until, what, Justin, you were moved out of the house, so.
Or close to it.
So. And it was like when it was really cheap right before the PlayStation 3 came out, probably.
Yeah, I think I got a PlayStation 2 specifically to play Guitar Hero, because I'm normally a Nintendo guy.
I've genuinely been looking at eBay for, like, PlayStation 2s, like, cheap ones, because, like, I just want to play some, like, old PlayStation games. I know I could probably, like, get a newer system and do their whatever downloadable... I don't know. Video games are very different from when I was playing them.
For sure.
It's like a hardware... I don't know how we got on this subject, but...
it's all my fault.
1977 is, yeah, it's the year of the first Clash record. We talked about the second Clash record as well, which gave them enough rope.
Yeah, which is so much better than the first record.
Well, you know, I had this long on that episode. We talked about it quite a bit, where I don't really like the Clash, and then I came back to this record, and I actually like this record much more than the later albums. So, like, I like Give Them Enough Rope the most, but I think I like the self-titled more than London Calling and any of the later stuff after that as well. But yeah, I think I just like the first two Clash records, and I don't really care for the more pop sensible side of them, I guess. But Talking Heads put out Talking Heads 77. It's the first Talking Heads record. It's got Psycho Killer on it. Not, would you call that punk? It's more new wave than anything, I guess. Or, I don't know, art punk's a weird tag.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, is Television really a punk band? You know.
Right.
I mean, they definitely came from that scene, which, you know, it's 1977. What punk is not very well defined.
Which we will talk about with our album.
So, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of what would later become, like, viewed more as art rock or... new wave, and they were all, you know, playing the same scenes. And, you know, Talking Heads were playing season, Ramones and Television were playing together, you know. Ramones and Talking Heads probably played together, I'm sure they did. So it's not all, you know, down strumming, you know, typical of what you think of punk in 77, though. I mean, that idea definitely starts to solidify in this year. I mean, with Sex Pistols, The Damned, you know, Dead Boys, all of those bands that would really define what punk was going forward really broke out in this year. But there's still some outsiders. I mean, you know, The Jam are like a who wanna be mod rock band, you know?
Yeah, and then you got like Radio Birdman and The Saints in Australia kind of doing their like Stooges influenced punk. Yeah,
that almost like Railroad Time like punk thing where it came from similar roots and appeared in a different continent, almost independent of each other, you know? Like, I think we... Because when you look at how The Saints formed and Radio Birdman formed, like, they couldn't have heard the Ramones when they started playing and started writing these songs. So it's funny that you have all of these influences percolating and then cropping up and coming out sounding very similar in different places, different cultures. And
It's really interesting to me, like, to try to imagine how, like, the music industry worked back then, because, like, so many of these albums, especially some of, like, the smaller ones that are, like, you know, were released this year, or were, like, released on, like, all these different labels in these different countries. I'm like, how did that, like, network end up forming and, like, working out and everything?
Yeah, it's real weird, because, you know, like, the Ramones and Talking Heads, and they were on, like, what, Sire? Like, we're pretty big record labels in the States. And then, like, the Clash and the Sex Pistols were on, like, major record labels in England. It's funny that, like, the independent roots of punk aren't really a thing yet. Like, the DIY aspect of punk that we, like, you know, is so closely identified to it is not quite there yet.
I mean, it's there in the sense that they were, you know, small local bands playing clubs, and that's how they got their recognition. And it was just still operating, the recording industry was still operating in such a structured, you get signed to a label by an A&R man, you know, you have your records distributed almost worldwide just from, you know, your first single. Like, if it does well enough in another country, then they keep pressing your records there. And so it started just like any DIY scene does, but it just got co-opted by the recording industry immediately. And you don't see that. Yeah, you really don't see that DIY as we know it, where it's like you have independent labels and you have self-released stuff until the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, recording and pressing records was so expensive then, too. It was just, like, not really feasible to do it on a DIY scale, totally.
Yeah, I guess it would take, like, the American hardcore movement, I guess, to really start it. You know, we've all seen the documentaries where Ian MacKaye is talking about how they peeled their record sleeves apart to figure out how to fold them and glue them. So, like, I guess everything was like, well, this is how you be a band. Like, there's no way you could possibly pay the pressing plant yourself to press your record. You have to have EMI do it for you. Yeah, that kind of segues pretty perfectly into our album, because it's definitely not your typical punk band of the era. So this week we are talking about FU2 and their album Punk Rock.
In Australia.
Or the first FU2 album, LP, I think is what it's called, in Germany or France, maybe. Yeah, that's one of these bands. So, Scott, when I sent you the list of albums that came out in 1977, I didn't expect you to pick this one. And I was wondering what made you pick this one out of all of those iconic records from super well-known bands.
I mean, I've always been like really interested in kind of like just diving into the more like obscure stuff and kind of finding, you know, the hidden gems. Like last year I bought like a old like punk comp of bands specifically from Connecticut, where I'm from. I bought it at, like, this record store that I had a gift card to, and then I was just, like, obsessed with, like, reading about, like, the punk history in Connecticut for, like, the next, like, month or so. So I've always been kind of, like, interested in those, you know, more obscure stuff that, you know, isn't really, like, you know, as well known. But, and I also just, like, having the balls to call your album punk rock is, like, I don't know. It just really caught my attention, being like, okay, if you think you're so punk rock, let me see what this sounds like.
The best part is they're not even the only one who called their album punk rock this year. So like, which we'll talk about in a minute, I guess. Yeah, let's. I'll run down. Man, so normally I run down like basics of the record, but the basics of this record are so like long and convoluted.
There's so many like paths that converge and diverge and come back together.
Right. I guess the only way to really talk about it is to just kind of go through it as it happened.
Yeah.
So this record has been called a secret Downliner Sect album. And Downliner Sect were a British rock band from the 60s. They were compared to the Yardbirds and the Rolling Stones. I listened to a little bit of it. I don't really know what to call them.
Yeah, I mean, it was very much like kind of like blues rocky. I saw like a lot of places call them like R&B, which obviously isn't the modern definition of R&B. but yeah, I listened to the most recent album that they put out before FU2's album. And it reminded me very much of like, you know, the early Beatles or like the start of like garage rock, like Louie, stuff like that.
It's crazy. They formed in 63. So they were right there at very early on in the, when it was still called beat music, you know, like.
Yeah. And the album that I listened to that was the most recent one was actually released in 66. So it was like, we were like 11 years removed from them even being really like an active band, I guess, but apparently they were pretty big. I saw on the Wikipedia for them, which they have a Wikipedia, I was surprised by, but I guess they influenced Van Morrison and Rod Stewart. Rod Stewart actually auditioned to be in the band at one point, but he wanted to be a front man, and the two front men didn't want to give up their position as front man.
So we talk about the Downliner Sect, but this isn't, oh man, it's how do you segue, how do you talk about this? So,
well, okay, like, that's the thing, like, that's the story, is that this has been presented for so long as a secret Downliner Sect record. You know, they went and made a fake punk record, but it's not really a Downliner Sect record, it's really only two of them.
Yeah,
plus special guests.
Yeah.
From the Downliner Sect.
Yeah, but not on the whole record.
Right. So, okay, let's talk about Terry DeVille, aka Terry Clemson.
Yeah, there are so many pseudonym, like, AKAs with this album. It's like, so much.
Yeah, so Terry DeVille, or Terry Clemson, as he was known in the Downliner Sect. Wait,
and I also saw him referred to as Terry Gibson.
Yeah, I saw that too. I don't know what his real name is. He had a friend named Eddie Bourne, who was asked to produce a punk album for a band called The Vacants. The Vacants are the other band who released a record called Punk Rock. Eddie,
also called The Worthless Trash.
Also released in a million different countries. Eddie asked Terry to come in and play some guitar for the record, basically working as like a session musician. And it sounds like he just had so much fun, he wanted to do a punk record himself. So he brought in Keith Grant, who on this record is credited as Art Less, who was also in the Downliners, to play bass, guitar, and do some vocals. So they had a couple songs written already for the Downliners, but they just didn't record them for whatever reason, or they didn't quite fit their sound.
They were actually recorded and released as a 7-inch, also in 77, as Downliner Sect. I apologize. Those were two separate songs by Downliner Sect, were recorded around the same time, it sounds like. From what I'm reading, it sounds like they were in the studio recording the two songs for the 7-inch as Downliner Sect. And that's when he was brought in to record for the Vacants. And then that's what led to to FU2.
Yeah. There's so much conflicting information, because like, Dylan, you were talking to me earlier today, and you were like telling me things, and I was like, that's not right. This is what's right. And now I don't even know what's even right anymore. So this FU2's record is basically two of the Downliners. They brought in their friends to fill out the band Clay Stone, a.k.a. Paul Holm, and Rob Grohn, a.k.a. Robin Langridge, to play drums and keys. They weren't members of the Downliners, but they wind up playing on Downliners Sex releases as well. It's funny, when you click on every single one of these names on this record, they all have done something with the Downliners Sect. So, like, whether or not they were all full members of the band, they did play on a record at some point. And the rest of this, the main musicians on this record is Paul Tone, a.k.a. Paul Tiller. There's a lot of Pauls in this band. he's on harmonica, and Mad Mick, a.k.a. Michael O'Donnell, plays guest guitar.
Also, a.k.a. Don Crane?
And Michael and Paul were both in the Downliners too, right? Like,
yes.
Yes. Paul Holm was the drummer.
Yeah, Robin Langridge. Yeah, it's so confusing. Like looking at who was in the band at what point.
This makes me love it even more, though.
It seems like Paul Holm and Robin weren't in that band yet. They just wound up playing on them later. But Paul Tiller and Michael O'Donnell were members of that band, I think.
Yeah, and the harmonica, from what I heard of the Downliner Sect, was a pretty substantial part of it, as well as on the FU2 album. And I really like it on the FU2 album.
We've talked about the confusing aspect of who was in the band and what bands they were in and from. Scott, did you like listening to it?
I did. I definitely enjoyed it. I mean, as soon as I turned it on, the first track starts with, you know, a drum beat and harmonica. And I was like, hell yeah, bring back harmonica in punk 2020. I'm here for it. I mean, overall, it was, you know, I thought it was kind of a basic early punk record. They weren't trying to add very many frills or anything, but I definitely enjoyed the experience overall.
Yeah, I was surprised by the harmonica as well, and very happy to hear it. It was a nice, like, addition to the 77 punk sound, which had yet to be fully defined at this point. It's so ill-defined at this point that this record sounds like four different types of punk bands all rolled into one. And there's the harmonica on a couple tracks, and it's probably my favorite part of the record. Like, it makes it stand out to me. Dylan, what did you think of this record?
I thought it was neat. It sounds good. Like, I think probably the weakest aspect are the vocals. Everything else is pretty interesting. Like, the guitars have a really nice, like, big rock sound. Good playing. You know, it's very much like bluesy rock and roll, Chuck Berry, you know, that kind of thing. I guess what would be in the 70s would best be called pub rock, which, you know, is like Dr. Feelgood and all of that, like sort of Rolling Stones-y, just generally a rock and roll feel. But it's good playing. It sounds, the guitar itself sounds really nice. The bass playing was really good, too. And everything, all of the songs, I mean, obviously it shows that they are competent musicians. I mean, they haven't been doing nothing since 1963, you know. they obviously were pretty good at playing their instruments to make a really enjoyable record in like a day, because that's the thing, they recorded and mixed the whole record in a day.
Yeah,
from what I've read. And it was like, like you said, they had two songs written, and then they just wrote a couple more, like 10 more.
Yeah.
And then recorded it in a day. And it comes out sounding way better than a record that someone cut almost as an afterthought. should sound.
Yeah, I actually checked out the Vandals punk or the Vacants punk rock record as well, and I like the FU2 a lot more. The Vacants had a pretty good cover of Beat on the Brat, which I enjoyed, but other than that, it was pretty lackluster for me. So it's interesting that was the one that inspired this, which I found much more enjoyable.
Yeah, the Vacants, like, I checked out the members of that band as well, and they didn't have a connection to a lot of other really well-known bands. Though one of them, I wish I knew off the top of my head who that was now.
The drummer was in The Pretenders.
That's it.
But also in some of the promo photos, he was replaced by a woman, so no clue what's going on there.
As a marketing thing, maybe? I don't know.
I think it was on either the Spanish or Australian or one of the countries ones. I'm not sure what the reasoning behind that was, though.
Yeah, I heard the Vacants and FU2 called Punksploitation on, and it was basically punk was this humongous thing in England in 77, so everybody kind of scrambled to we need to do a punk record too, and some of it came from true inspiration. There's the Damned were inspired by the Sex Pistols to release their record as fast as possible, but then there's a band a pub rock band Big Balls and the Great White Idiot, or one of those off-brand punk, 77 punk bands that let's just get something out there real quick to make a quick buck, or
there was a very quick this is the future of rock music, so we need to hurry up and get in line with it. And then of course it didn't really pan out and those bands all fizzled,
and you could almost tell that it was people don't really talk about the Outsiders or the Drones or Eater the way that they talk about the Pistols and Clash and or even the Jam. I feel like even the Stranglers and the Vibrators have a better reputation than some of the other ones that also released records that year.
Sorry, I just had to close my blinds real quick. Sorry for that, it's special effects.
Sound like a toy car running across the floor.
But yeah, I connected with the name Punksploitation a little bit more than fake punk, because I feel like they did kind of nail down the attitude really well. So in that way, I don't know, it had that feeling of genuineness to it, but also really kind of leaning into it maybe more than you would otherwise, for sure.
It's interesting. I saw someone talk about how this record is called a fake punk record, and they said it's kind of ironic because Downliner Sect were already doing that punk rock attitude much earlier, being a British rhythm and blues, whatever, they had already kind of had that garagey snarl.
Yeah, and actually the 7-inch that I mentioned earlier that they did record and release in 77, and I think that was actually out of everything that I listened to surrounding this album, the track Showbiz ended up being my favorite, that original version. They did re-record it for the next Downliner Sect album that came out, but it had the original version had a really good mix of the kind of more bluesy rocky feel of their older stuff with the kind of punk energy of FU2. And it's really interesting because I did also listen to the 79 album. What I could find of it, I couldn't find the full album actually, but it definitely had more of the energy from FU2 than their older stuff did. But because it's it was so far removed and the timelines are so confusing, it's can't really tell exactly whether it was FU2 that kind of changed it for them, or whether it was just the fact that the music landscape had changed so much since their last full length in 66.
releases, like, there was such a big gap between releases for them. Because, like, if you look at the Downliner Sec discography, there's a lot of stuff, you know, out there. But I guess a lot of it came out after. Like, maybe they got re-inspired to do those records.
Yeah, they actually released stuff as recently as, like, 2008 or 9. I think they had a new full-length. And then even more recent, they released, like, a re-recorded version of some of their songs. And I saw they had a concert canceled due to COVID. And it was rescheduled for this November.
I saw that, like, some of the guys played in the Headcoats Sect, which that's a era of music. Like, that's a whole thing that I don't have any understanding of whatsoever. Like, there's the Headcoats, the Headcoatees, the Headcoat Sect. Like, there's a lot of other, like, so I'm assuming with sect in the name.
From what I can tell, it's essentially Downliner Sect with Billy Childish, which is where
Billy Eilish,
which is where they get the whole the Headcoats, because he's the guy behind all of those Headcoats,
yeah,
bands, which yeah. is a whole thing that I don't understand.
Yeah, I've never attempted to learn anything about that, and it's always confusing when I see it. One of the things I thought that made this record stand apart from some of the other ones was, like, it felt like, because he was, like, just around when they recorded a punk record, he was like, this is fun. I want to do that. It feels more, like, authentic. It's like older guys who were playing a different kind of music who were like, ah, that's kind of fun. Why don't we try that, too? Like, it didn't come across as, like, this, like, cash-in, because I don't know that it really sold that well.
Well, and that's the thing. They really didn't make any attempt to be FU2. Like, they gave it a name because they needed a name to sell it under, and they didn't want to sell it as Downliner Sect because they didn't want to only do that. Like, they weren't going to commit to that sound entirely. It was just kind of, it seems like it was just like, hey, this is fun. Let's do it and then release it. And they had really no commercial ambition for it, which is kind of more punk than any of the other punk bands that were active at this time. Because there was no real ambition other than just to make some fun songs with a certain sound and attitude, and they did it well. Like, they accomplished it.
Yeah, I feel like they had some pretty good one-liners on there. Like in Tax Exile, one of the lines is like, "Art for art's sake, money for Christ's sake, give it to me, give it to me, give it to me, or give it to me." I'm like, that's like, I like that line.
That song, I really enjoyed that one. I thought it was funny, too, because it seemed like a pointed, like, a critique of, like, the Rolling Stones, you know, because they did that. I mean, they let, you know, they had to leave England because they owed so many taxes. That's why they moved to the United States. So it's funny to see them kind of poking fun at their contemporaries, who went on to be way more successful, obviously, but...
I was just going to say, that song has this, like, a really nice build at the end, too, where they just, like, keep saying, like, give it to me. And, like, it, like, builds up really nicely, kind of like the song Horses by Patti Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to think of, like, because punk was so ill-defined in 77, like, what some of these songs sounded like. And, like, there's the Chuck Berry style stuff. Like, Playing My Guitar is, like, a straight-up punk version of a Chuck Berry song.
Yeah.
Which they also wrote already. That was one of the ones that existed before, which I don't know how that would have fit with their more, like, psych beat thing they were doing.
They actually re-recorded that one, that and Out of School for the 79 Downliner Sect album, and they're very watered down versions of it. I definitely enjoyed these versions more.
Yeah, so, like, Tax Exile has, like, a Ramonesy vibe. The third track, Manic Depression, has, like, the Kinks, You Really Got Me Going guitar line.
I have that in my notes, too. and I actually noticed I accidentally hit play on Playing My Guitar for a second time instead of going to Tax Exile at one point. And the first, like, couple bars of it are exactly the same. Like, the drum beat and then the guitar melody is, like, exactly the same for the first, like, 5 or 10 seconds.
Yeah, and then there's, like, there's at some point on the record, I feel like they give up the punk idea. Like, Move Around just feels like a 60s rock song with some keys. And like Out of School has more of like a, I don't know, like a Steppenwolf or the Deep Purple vibe to it than a punk sound.
Yeah, I think in order to write all of these songs as quickly as they did, they kind of fell back on muscle memory to just play what was familiar to them.
I was looking at one of the bios I read for this record. I think it was for the reissue in 2012. It brought up that the song Stiff and Glue was covered by the band The Exploding Hearts.
Yeah.
And I'd actually kind of forgotten the story of The Exploding Hearts. They were set to sort of be this next big thing. Their like one record was really critically acclaimed. It was doing like the retro rock thing like The Strokes or The Hives were doing at the time, but with a more of a punk slant to it. And but they were going to like talked about it as like, oh, these guys are going to be huge. And then they got into a car accident and three of the four members died. And so it was like this real sad thing of like, oh, what could have been. You know, I listened to their version and I do think their version's a little better than the version on this record. I thought that was one of the weaker tracks on here.
I really liked the like weird ass keyboard sounds going on in it. but other than that, I thought it was like, yeah, a pretty basic track. And I'm like, what was like the early punk obsession with sniffing glue? Like the Ramones now want to sniff some glue. And I feel like there are other examples of that I can't think of right now. But like, it seems like such a kind of random thing to be part of punk.
They really just were sniffing glue. I mean, at least in the case of the Ramones. I mean,
it was if they knew thing. Directions, they just had to listen to this song because it was literally like stick the head up your nose or whatever. I think that was one of the lines, something like that. It seemed, but again, like that was one of the ones that screamed the most like fake punk to me. Like that one seemed kind of like more disingenuous than some of the other tracks.
Yeah, like were the Downliners really sniffing glue in 1977? Yeah, I don't know how old they were. I would assume maybe mid to late 30s by 77. Unless they were like literal children when they started. But there's some interesting stuff on this record. Overall, I'd say it's a good attempt at punk when they don't really get it, what it is. And they're really good at their instruments. So it works out for the better, way more than the Vacants record does.
I thought surprisingly like nailed down the punk sound or the punk like attitude pretty well for, you know, the fact that punk was so ill-defined at the time.
Yeah, I was looking at, it's so funny, like, they were a UK band, and, like, punk was a huge thing in England in 77, but it was never released in England. So, like, it was released in Australia under the name Depressions. It was released in Italy, which has a different track listing, which puts the FU2, the final track on the record, as the first track.
It works so well as a final track, though, so I don't understand that.
Yeah, that's how I listened to it.
Which version?
I listened to it with FU2 at the end of the record.
Yeah, that's the original. The original? It's the French version.
It's the intended sequence.
Yeah, I think it is. Because it was released in France, Italy, Spain, and Australia in 77. And then I think the French version and the Spanish version are the most well-known.
Yeah, the cover on Apple Music is the Spanish version one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it even has, like, has Spanish words on the cover. I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, it's I think it's in my notes. It's like the sound of the new wave or something like that.
Yeah, La Nueva Olla Ola del Punk Rock. And it's a literal pile of trash on the front.
And also, like, going back to the fact that it was, like, had such a small release, like, how did the Exploding Hearts, like, I wonder how they stumbled upon the album in order to cover Sniffin' Glue.
So, I read that it had been, that it was released in 77 and then bootlegged, like, a ton. So, for some reason, somehow, this record, people just kept bootlegging it. So, there are, I guess, just these secondhand versions of it, which I want to hear the totally degraded
right
audio that they were listening to, and they were like, let's cover that.
Yeah, I saw references to, like, mass bootlegging as well. I was really surprised that there's not, like, more list, like, there's 10 listings for it on Discogs, but, like, three of those are, like, past the time that the Exploding Hearts recorded it, and there's only, like, two listed within unknown year. So I'm surprised there's not more, like, pressings of it listed on Discogs.
Yeah, like, I assume they probably heard one of those bootleg copies, because it was, like, made in the 90s, so that would be, like, the perfect timing for them. And yeah, you're right, there were two pressings after the Exploding Hearts. So there was a Japanese pressing on CD in 2008, and on 1977 Records, so I imagine that was just, like, somebody who had a record label in Japan who loved 77 punk. It was like, let's find as much of it as we can and put it out.
Yeah, there's, like, a surprising amount of, you know, like, little labels in, like, Japan and, like, Italy, especially. Those two, like, seem to be really, like, entranced or really, like, enthralled by, like, that super early punk stuff, which is, I mean, it's awesome that they're, like, archiving it in the way that they are.
Yeah, and then there was the 2012 edition done by 1234 Go Records and distributed by No Idea, which it's funny that it specifically says distributed by No Idea Records.
I'm pretty sure they actually had, like, the original master tapes for that and maybe even remastered it. I'm not sure about that, though.
Yeah, that's where, like, all the liner notes come from. As far, I think they did say it was based on the original tapes. So and that one uses, like, the purple cover. Because, like, all the different versions have different album covers. The Australian one has them, it's like just a photo of them. That one's the weird one to me. It's like, it doesn't really have the vibe of the others. But then,
yeah, I mean, yeah. The Italy one is almost like metal, like with the skull, and, like, punk rock words are, like, dripping down in blood. There's, like, safety pins and stuff.
Yeah,
the Australian one uses the version that's called Depressions. Which, where did they even get that title from? But that's one that they
it's made not a lyric. It's not.
Yeah. Well, there's Manic Depression. That's the song.
That's true.
But they made it look like an AC/DC record, like the font that they used. I guess that was just, we're going to stamp this font on everything in Australia. That's how they'll know it's a rock record.
it's got
electrical font.
Yeah, the 1234 Go pressing uses the French purple cover, which has, like, safety pins and just says punk rock in giant letters on the front. I do kind of like the Spanish version the most, though, because it's just a pile of trash with, like, big chunky green, like, punk rock written on the cover.
Twice. It's on there twice.
Yeah.
Which would, actually, that would have been more fitting for the Vacants version, which is in, I think it's Australia. It's called Worthless Trash, but it's not, I don't know, I don't think the cover is, let me pull it up. Yeah, the cover, it's for the Australian version. It's called Worthless Trash, the Vacants one. And then it's just a promo photo of them, which kind of messed up their marketing department. Could have done better.
Yeah, and I was wondering, like, oh, maybe they got it in, like, a bundle deal. Maybe they did, because the Australian one is the same record label.
Yeah, they were sold together. I think they were sold together. Like, you got both records in one. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, the others all have different record labels that released it. So that's the only one that released both FU2 and The Vacants. It also got bootlegged a bunch of times as well.
And again, has me wondering how the music industry worked in 1977.
Yeah, like, how do these UK bands not get their records released in England, but they could get some Italian label to do it for them?
Yeah, so the Vacants version, the Vacants record, it wasn't issued in England either, was it?
So unless...
Yeah, I don't think it was.
Unless Eddie Bourne had something to do with their distribution.
I think I read that he was Italian. I think he had something to do with that, maybe the Italian distribution. I'm not positive about that. I might be mixing everything up in my head.
Yeah, there's like so many names attached to this record. He also produced a House Shakers record in 72. And he has credits for acting, literary, and spoken on a couple other records that I don't know what those are. They're all for Contour Records. Gunter Kalman Choir, Nori Paramore and his orchestra, Sasha Distel, Blue Blow, Reggae Party Time. I want to hear that record.
Yeah, right?
Eddie Fisher sings his greatest hits of the 50s. Like, I don't know who this guy is. And so, what is he?
Spoken word? So is he like narrating? He's like, and now you are listening to Blue Blow.
It's got to be like one of those, like, those records that get sampled all the time by like Dillinger Four, where it's like just like on the balls of your feet you dance up and down, you know, like that kind of dance record stuff. Blue Blow, I want to hear that record now. It's all covers, all reggae covers. I'm gonna listen to that later.
You mentioned dance hall just now or something, and I think I don't know if it was on one of the tracks on this record or one of the other ones I listened to, but it had like the kind of like classic, like the pick it up, pick it up, pick it up in it. it might have been one of the ones on the Downliner Sect 79 album. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't remember anything like that.
But I was like really surprised. I was like, oh, interesting.
It's so funny. Like, the story of this record is far more interesting than the music is. Not that the music's bad. It's just, I think there's more to talk about with the behind the scenes stuff than the... It just kind of reminds me, it's like, man, they could make a really cool documentary about this for like, you know, a little like hour and a half long documentary. It'd be the next band named Death documentary or something like that.
I'd definitely watch it. I mean, apparently they're still around, so if someone's inspired by this episode, they can reach out. The link on their website to like their Facebook page is literally just like one of the members' personal Facebook.
For the Downliners, or is it?
For the Downliners.
Yeah, it's. I assume that's how everyone talks about them too. The Downliners.
Right.
Saying the whole name.
I think they refer to themselves as Sect. For their shorthand.
Weird. I just naturally want to call them the Downliners.
Like they said that this the FU2 record wasn't a Sect record. How they raised it up.
It's Downliners.
The American versus the English.
Yeah. It's ending your word with an S and starting your next one with an S that makes it kind of a mouthful to say. Well, did we hit all our notes on this record?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much all I had. I did want to say, how I really thought FU2 was a good outro. Them kind of like fading out with the, we don't give a fuck, we say FU2. It's just like, it's classic. Loved it.
I could see why they wanted to move it to the beginning of the record for the Italian pressing, but at the same time, it's such a good ender to the record. It's really strong, and it was a single for the... It was the lead single, I believe? I think it's the A-side to that single.
Yeah, I think so.
And what's the B-side? Is it,
Looks like it was Star in the Streets, which actually was another one that I wanted to just mention as a highlight. I thought it was, you know, kind of one of the more, you know, typical, like, punk songs in both sound and the attitude. Like, the lyric, "We do what we want, so fuck you," and then you read about in your Sunday papers, "We don't care, we're stars in the streets," is, like, that sounds, that's, like, really kind of exemplifies, you know, a punk attitude, in my opinion.
Yeah, that song, like, really stood out to me when I was listening to the record. I was like, this is kind of, like, dynamic. It's got a lot going on. It has, like, that drum-only intro. Yeah, it seems more mature than what this record probably called for.
Yeah, so that's actually almost, like, in my opinion, like, a double A-side rather than an A and B-side 7-inch.
Yeah, because how many... You're not going to get too much radio play when you say, "fuck you too" in the lyrics of your song, so...
Yeah, both of those songs are the ones that dropped the bombs.
I do wonder, though, like, yeah, playing my guitar and Tax Exile would probably be, like, your lead singles today, but, yeah, they were interesting choices. I mean, FE2 is, like, one of those definitive band name of song songs, you know, like, Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath, Motorhead by Motorhead, and it's kind of a thing that was happening in the 70s.
Yeah, if you had any question what that FU2 stood for anything besides fuck you two, then that answered it.
Yeah, it's got a weird abbreviation too. It's always like with the dots, like F dot U dot two, but no dot at the end of two. It's
yeah, I think I saw somewhere of it with FU right next to each other and then a dash two. That might have been one of the bootlegs or something.
I think that's the Depression's version.
Yeah, those Australians doing it weird. You know, overall, I'd say it's worth listening to. I mean, we play samples of the songs on the episodes. So, like, if you like what you hear in these little clips, it's worth checking out. I think it should maybe be higher rated than it is. But I'm assuming that's because it's just not as well known. And it does get talked about a lot. It has a very cultish, like, reputation online.
Yeah, it's definitely plugged into the Blogspot scene.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like, it's primarily Blogspots talking about it. And a lot of UK blogs, too.
I really do. I love a good Blogspot band, where it's just like, you search them, and that's like the only thing that comes up is just Blogspot after Blogspot, usually with downloads available.
Just these old orphaned, like, rapid share links from 2008.
don't work anymore.
You just have the accompanying Discog or the accompanying Blogspot file sharing pages.
And I was actually surprised, like, at least on Apple Music, I think there might be some downliner stuff on Spotify, but out of, like, all the kind of related stuff that we've talked about in this episode, the FU2 album was the only one that I was able to find on Apple Music.
Yeah, I use Spotify, and it's, like, it's on there, but a lot of the downliners albums are not really on there. Maybe, like, the later ones, the ones they did in the 80s. There's, like, a compilation that's, like, 63 through 65 or something like that. And they're really, really rough versions. It's got a version of, like, Roll Over Beethoven that, like, skips a bunch in it. And I don't know if that was...
Oh, my. That's awesome.
I don't know if that's how the song was actually recorded or if it's just... It was ripped from...
Yeah, I feel like it was ripped from a scratchy vinyl.
Yeah, it's, like, a repeating skip. Like, it's, like... And I think it's on purpose, the way it is. It's like roll on over, like it skips every time after roll on over. So I feel
that
like
might
it was
be a little tongue-in-cheek then.
Yeah. But they were way more psych than I expected them to be for like 64. So, you know, fortunately they didn't do another FU2 record. Though, I mean, you know, by 78, punk in UK was already quote-unquote over. It was on to the next trendy thing. It was all doing post-punk now, and Two Tone had like really blown up, and so I mean, yeah, because they weren't like a punk band, that's why they didn't come back to it.
Yeah, some of the stuff on the 79 album that they put out that I listened to sounded, you know, like I said, it had the more energy of, you know, coming from FU2, but it definitely had more of a, you know, classic rock, quote unquote, vibe, especially like the lead single Showbiz. It was like, you know, kind of bordering on the cringe.
who was on that record from this EP? It's all of them, right? We've got Paul Holm, Paul Tiller, Terry Gibson, Keith Grant, Robin. Yeah, it's all of them. So
yeah.
Yeah, it motivated them to make another Downliner Sect record. I wonder what their legacy really is going to be, though. If it'll be the Downliners or FU2.
I had never heard of Downliner Sect before this.
Apparently, at one point, they were iconic, according to Wikipedia. Yeah. Literally, they used the word iconic.
They probably had more esteem in the UK.
For sure.
And they just were one of those bands that just didn't really make it ever to the U.S. substantially.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Downliners biography, and it's like, it doesn't really seem like it had a huge impression.
They were on Columbia, which is like, you know,
true.
It was big at the time and stuff, but yeah, I don't know. I definitely feel like I found more about FU2 than Downliners Sucked.
Yeah, and I mean, they have another huge gap. After the 79 record, they don't have any more releases until 91, so...
Yeah, there's like a live record in 86.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes you wonder, too, because I know a lot of those members from those 60s records have nothing to do with the later, with Showbiz and later, so...
It almost makes you wonder if they should have just leaned into being FU2.
Right? Yeah, I actually saw on one of, probably like the blog spots or whatever, I saw reference to them for that 79 record having signed to, or like having working on releasing it with the people who put out the 7-inch that they did record in 77 at around the same time as the FU2 album. And there's a quote from apparently the person who ran that record label, Raw Records, that says, "I recorded an album with them. I paid many thousands of pounds, and then they stole the tapes from the studio and sold the tapes to a German record label." So, and then the blog spotters their commentary is, "I suppose that's a punk rock thing to do." So I guess they kept the punk in that form.
That's weird. It's weird to just sell it to like other, they apparently had like a really big following in Swedish pirate radio too.
Of course.
Why not?
So weird. Yeah, they should have leaned into FU2 because I think history is, you know, we have the hindsight of looking at it now. I feel like people have a higher regard for this FU2's record than they do any of the Downliner Sect records. So, I don't know, maybe they should have leaned into it and we'd be more familiar with them. Well, I guess since there's not a lot and any other material for really talk about when it comes to them, that'll probably do it for the album for us then. Scott, thanks so much for doing the show and for choosing this odd little gem.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun, you know, diving into the history of it and then discussing it. You know, it was something I'd love to do more often.
Oh, for sure. We'll have to have you back. Yeah, like when I looked at that list, I was like, hell yeah, this list is going to be like something real cool. And then you're like, let's pick that one. It's got a weird name. I'm like, all right. All right. But it was worth it.
I think as far as some of the really obscure records that we've done, especially like the 70s and 80s records that we've done, this is really high on the list in terms of quality. It might even be like the best of the, like, who's this? You know, weird, obscure records that we've done, like MX80 or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, we did like a bunch of art punk records, and like people didn't really care about who they were, or if they did, they were like, "How dare you not enjoy this Flipper record?" Flipper's not that obscure, but
that stuff is like so hit or miss. Like, but that's part of the fun of like, it's basically like going to Goodwill or going to, you know, whatever thrift shop record store, whatever, you know, and just kind of like digging through and grabbing whatever catches your eye.
You know, I listened to a lot of other records on this list to kind of get in like the 77 mode to figure out like what were the other bands doing at the same time? And there's some other more obscure releases that came out, but like there's a record by a band called the Slicky Boys, who were like a US band. Not good. That Vacants record, not nearly as good. Like, oh, it's surprising to see this as like, who's this? And it actually be good, because you know, there's a better chance of it not being that great.
Yeah, I definitely feel like we lucked out with the lotto of 77, and then the lotto of me randomly choosing one that caught my eye. Which I do have to say, I was almost going to choose the Vacants version of punk rock, because the album cover, I think it's the French album cover. It's like this strange, like weird body shape that's like kind of like a weird art collage type thing, and that album artwork caught my eye a little more, but the name FU2 caught my eye even more.
You know, I almost wish we had enough foresight or like research, and then we could have like done each record, like done it together. Like, I, you know, like I didn't make nearly as many notes on the Vacants as I did with this record, so I kind of wish that now we had done them together in tangent, because they match up so well on every aspect, really. Like, you feel like you can't talk about one without talking about the other. So
Looking at a Blogspot that has a bunch of, it basically has every edition of the Vacants record, and all of the covers are really fun and like kind of goofy, but there's an 8-track, and it says England's punk rock craze, the Vacants.
And it wasn't even
like
really
a spray paint font over like a monochrome picture of a brick wall. It's like they were part of that craze, I guess.
Which is that's funny too. Like going back to what I've mentioned a couple times about like just being interested about how the music industry worked back then. But like, I mean, you could literally like, you could say England punk rock craze, this band, and no one would know whether they really were a craze in England or not. Like, that album wasn't even released in England. I guess generally punk rock was the craze in England, though.
Yeah, that 8-track came out in Canada too, so it's like, it's not even, there's no language barrier there. It's just like, yeah, this was a hit in England, sure. And
that's what they told us.
That's what the distributor said to us.
That's what the history books will say.
Well, it said it on the cover, so it's got to be true.
Which, I mean, I guess maybe that's how records like this made it to so many other countries. Like, you strike a deal with a distributor, and the distributor gets the record from you super cheap, and then all they have to do is basically call these other countries and say, hey, you want this punk rock record? It's a big craze in England. And they go, oh, sure, if it's popular in England, it'll sell great here. And to an extent, you probably could actually just slap UK British punk band on the cover, and people would go, ooh, cool, and buy it.
It was their own form of a punk lotto.
Like, yeah, it's just
what,
like,
what
all
other
those
punk records am I gonna buy? This is it.
Yeah. I'm gonna buy this one that says punk rock, or this other one that says punk rock. They both cost $3, so which one is it gonna be? Because these were definitely like cheap records that you could get.
Yeah, the Spanish version of the Vacants version of punk rock, it has like 295 PTS. I'm not sure what that
sounds like
equivalent
it'd be cheap.
Is, but that seems the branding seems very cheap.
Yeah. You know, when it has like the dollar amount printed on the actual cover, it's probably pretty cheap.
The, like, specially priced.
Mm-hmm. The nice price.
Yeah.
That currency isn't actually even used in Spain anymore. It was discontinued in 2002.
Wow. I wonder, that's weird. I wonder what that is then, for it to be like a discontinued amount. Did they switch to the euro, I guess?
Let's see. It looks like you said it was like 299, somewhere around there.
Yeah, like
299. Yeah.
I don't know. This is for their current. Never mind. I thought I pulled it up, but it's for whatever they have now.
No, we need the exchange rate.
Oh, no. Yeah, it says ESP. Yeah, okay, so I don't know why PTS is also labeled as ESP, but it looks like that was about $2.
Yeah, it sounds about right. Like, you wouldn't put that on the cover and it'd be like, five was kind of a normal price for a record, I think. 5 to 7. Because, like, all those Discord records say, like, do not sell for more than $5. And that's, like, 80. So, yeah. I guess that'll do it this week. Scott, where can everyone check out your show? What social medias you want us to follow? And all that good stuff?
Yeah, so, I mean, the show's pretty much everywhere. Apple Podcasts, Spotify. It's on the Alternatives Mixcloud, who, you know, kind of teamed up with me to help promote the show. And it's Twitter and Instagram at Fly on the Call Pod. And yeah, feel free to hit me up, suggest guests, let me know what you're listening to, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I highly recommend the show. And then we're on all our regular social medias. We are Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We're at Punklotto Pod. We didn't really talk about it at the beginning, but you know, the world's kind of fucked up right now. So do everything you can to help out. Especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, that just because it's not in the news cycle anymore, it doesn't mean it's not important. Today, as I'm recording this today, in Charlotte, there was a bail support system that was basically had everyone arrested. So, kind of, you know, the fight's not over. You know, I know we're taking a break and talking about, you know, goofy punk records from the 70s, but there's still stuff we can do. But yeah, that'll do it for this week, and... yeah, we'll talk to you next time.